thank you so much for joining Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and Hashtag No Limits is about people who society places limits upon but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better or more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. Little quick science lesson here for those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves back into its cells and then reforms into the butterfly. Now, that's the super simple scientific explanation. There's a whole lot more, but that's the basic gist of it. But it's not finished. Even after going through that, it has to struggle to get out of the cocoon for its wings to be strong enough to take it everywhere that it will soar. And I think that that has to be incredibly difficult, but so is busting through those limits that society places upon people. Mm-hmm. Today, we're going to talk about something, and I want to kind of give a little warning maybe about today's episode. We are going to talk about sexual abuse. And I just want to let you all know that up front so that you can tune out if you want to, or that you can prepare yourself for some of the things that might be discussed today. Please be sure, if you are watching, that you like and subscribe to this channel and leave us a hashtag live and where you're watching from, or a hashtag replay and where you're watching from. So I think all the business is out of the way. Welcome to my guest, Keeper. How are you today?
Shelley, I am fantastic. Happy to be here at Hashtag No Limits. I've been looking forward to this conversation. We're going to be getting into some things that could be triggering for people. And like you said, and I agree, if you need to back away, then back away. Protect yourself by all means. Come back. Shelley and Hashtag No Limits will be here. You could always take it in chunks if you have to. So looking forward to spending some time with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I very much appreciate your candor about this topic. It is something that typically my guests are people who have neurodiversity or, they've helped someone with neurodiversity, and people, especially girls that are neurodiverse, have a 12 times more likelihood of being sexually abused, neglected, and human trafficked. Boys who are neurodiverse have a 7 times more likelihood of that happening to them. And so while this is a very difficult topic, I think it is very important for a huge portion of my audience, but truly for every portion of my audience, for us to have some empathy and be aware of what's going on. And you have a very unique perspective that, until I talked with you beforehand, hadn't ever really thought about that perspective. So go ahead and introduce your background and who you are, and let's get this conversation rolling.
Oh, absolutely. Just up front, I want to acknowledge the neurodivergent part of the conversation. I have a son who is neurodivergent, so I do have some background in that. With that said, I am Keeper Catherine Whitney. I am the author of the book Helplessness, the emotional health challenges brothers experience once we learn our sisters have been sexually abused by our parents. It is from a brother's perspective, Helplessness, and it is the very first book of its kind that not only asks the question, what do brothers go through, but answers the question, what do brothers go through? Because once the betrayal has been exposed or has come to light, no one ever asked the brothers, how do you feel? What are you dealing with? Is there anything you need? Can I help you with anything? We are often viewed as disposable, our emotions around, once we have learned it. We're often viewed as taboo, or even worse, an inconvenient truth, a truth that no one wants to acknowledge. Brothers are dealing with stuff. We are very often just put on a shelf, tucked away, and expected to deal with it on our own. And so Helplessness looks at what happens to brothers emotionally. Because for me, it is not about the mental health aspect of it yet. It is always about the emotional trauma that we experience initially. And then where do we go from there? So I'm happy to be having this conversation with you in particular, Shelley, just knowing your background.
Well, thank you. As I said before, this is a perspective that I haven't thought about before. I've not thought about brothers or sisters, you know, siblings finding out that their loved one has been abused by their parents, the people who, in I think most children's minds, are there to protect you and keep all of that bad stuff away. And so talk about the betrayal you said you felt when you heard that your sisters had been abused.
Sure. Perhaps it will be good to give everyone some context. Yes. I come from a family of 10, four boys, four girls, my mother and my stepfather. That's who I'll be talking about. My biological father was out of the picture years before that. In 1971, we were incredibly poor. We grew up in South Central Los Angeles. In fact, I lived in 21 different places before I graduated high school. Wow. I went to 11 grade schools. I was homeless three times. We just could not make ends meet no matter what we did. So in 1971, my mother, who was a very excellent singer, just fantastic, got together with her brother and her sister and decided to form a group so they could make some extra money. But as great as they were, they could not make enough money to help our situation. Now, keep in mind, in 1971, Shelley, the Jackson Five were blowing up. I mean, Michael Jackson, his brothers, they were everywhere. Whatever you turned on the radio, all you heard was ABC, Who's Loving You? I Want You Back. I mean, it was everywhere.
Right.
And so me and my brothers, we were doing the same thing. And my sisters, we were doing the same thing. And one day my mother says, would you guys like to sing? Because as a singing family, we could make more money. So, of course, we jumped at the opportunity. Next thing you know, me and my seven brothers and sisters and my mother and my stepfather were singing at after-hour nightclubs all over Los Angeles. It was amazing. We had never sung before, but here we are singing in front of packed houses and nightclubs. One Saturday, we're rehearsing and the phone rings and my mother says, shh, and walks over to the telephone and says, hello? Who? And she looks at us and says, Michael Jackson's on the phone. Yes.
What?
That Michael Jackson, soon to be King of Pop, is calling our house.
Wow.
You have to be kidding me. Absolutely. It's what just happened. He wants to speak to the brother directly under me, child number four. I am child number two. My brother gets on the phone. Hello, all excited. Hangs up and screams, Michael Jackson said he's heard of us. Said for us to keep going, we'll get there someday. Now, what child could not build a life around dreams like that? I mean, you have just been coronated. I mean, the guy just said, right? You guys are it. Jump cut 7 years later, 1977, I am a senior in high school. We are with United Artists Records and we are everywhere. We are doing concerts. We are doing TV shows. We're on the cover of magazines. We're everywhere. And 1977 is the same year Motown completes a three-year exhaustive search to replace Michael Jackson and Jackson 5. And guess who they settled on?
Oh, my gosh.
Me and my family.
That's crazy.
Yes, the Whitney family had arrived. In fact, Michael Jackson's words not only manifested, but they manifested in such a way that we're about to replace him. Oh, my goodness. In fact, the woman who discovered them, Suzanne DePass, is walking us through the front door to sign the largest new artist contract Motown offered anybody. Fame and fortune, I like to say the bus was outside, the engine was running, the door was open. All we had to do was step onto the bus and we were gone. A life of abject poverty is over. No more going to parks to get government cheese and milk and powdered eggs. Those days were over. We are about to sign this contract on a Thursday or Friday coming up. My oldest sister screams upstairs the Saturday leading up to it. And I'm thinking, okay. She says, boys, come downstairs, family meeting. This is it. We're about to find out when we're going to do this deal. I'm just too happy. I'm like, finally. I come downstairs and I walk into the living room. And as I walk into the living room, Shelley, My oldest sister is pacing back and forth in front of the archway leading into the living room, and she is pissed. Okay. She and my mom could get into it from time to time. And earlier that day, she and my sisters and my mom were into it, going back and forth from bedroom to bedroom, bathroom, just screaming and whatever. I'm like, okay, it's the girls being the girls. It's my right. oldest sister and my mom doing their thing. So I walk into the living room. And as I walk, I look at the couch. And my three youngest sisters are huddled in the far corner, not saying a word. This is really odd. Because all they ever did was laugh, joke, and tease. That's who we were. It was our core. We were just energetic. But here they are, not saying a word. Okay, that's odd. At the other end of the couch are my two youngest brothers. They're also quiet, but they're like me. They're like, what's up with the girls? Why is she pacing back and forth? Why are the baby girls, which is what we call them, the three youngest of us eight, why do they look scared? Oh, well, okay, I'm gonna go sit down. But as I go sit down, I look at my oldest brother who's standing behind my sisters at the far end of the couch, and we lock eyes on each other. They were like, okay, fine. We're about to become rich. Whatever's happening here is not about, it's just not going to be a thing. Mm-hmm. So I sit on the couch between my youngest sisters and my youngest brothers. And within seconds, my mother and my stepfather enter. Now, my stepfather, 6'6", 250 pounds, and wore a huge Afro wig that put his height over 7 feet tall. He's a mountain.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, exactly. He's a mountain of a man. I'm like 5'8", 145 pounds. He swallows me whole if he wanted to. He walks, Shelly, and he sits in the brown recliner that's in the middle of the living room, and it clashes violently with the green carpet. But he goes and he sits down and immediately does this.
Oh.
What the hell? Is he sick?
Right?
Huh. My mother, who's usually effervescent, bubbly like her children, is stoic. She's not smiling. And she walks to the middle of the living room and stands in front of this huge window that overlooks the outside. And she's glaring. And I notice she stops and locks eyes on my oldest sister. And if looks could kill, they would have killed each other.
Oh, my.
I don't know what the hell is going on.
Right.
So my mother is standing there. And I'm expecting to hear the most joyous news of my life. No longer food stamps, no longer going into the streets to look for bottles to turn in for a bag of rice or a pound of ground beef. All those days were over now. We're about to replace the Jackson 5.
Right.
Now, I live in Southern California. And we have earthquakes all the time. In fact, in the past couple of months, we've had 8 or 9 earthquakes. They just happen all the time. Those, to me, are material in nature, meaning that there's nothing really emotional attached to the actual act of them, but mm-hmm. you do suffer some trauma and, you know, just some fear. And freeways crack, homes, you know, they rack back and forth.
Sure.
Trees are uprooted. Okay, a little rebar, a little concrete, a little, you know, hammer and nails, pop, 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 put it back together, back on the road, mow the lawn, back in the house. Those are material in nature.
Right.
My three brothers and I are about to be hit with three emotional earthquakes in a 10-minute span. We are about to hear the words no brother could ever prepare for, ever expects to hear. Earthquake number one. My mother looks at us, with no emotion whatsoever, Shelley. None. And she says, your stepfather has been molesting your sisters for years.
Oh my gosh.
What? Wait a minute. What did you say? No, no, no. What did you say? I start dropping. I'm a brother. There's no way I could prepare for this. I'm about 16 or 17, and I don't know what to do. I am being paralyzed emotionally. I would learn years later, this is what my sisters and mother were discussing that morning. This is the day we're going to tell the four boys. This is the day their brothers would know what has been going on for 6 years. The same 6 years ago when we started singing and Michael Jackson called our house. No idea what's been going on. So I'm knocked backwards emotionally and I'm dropping into a void. I only remember three words that she said: liquor store, apartment, and park. Other than that, I am slow on uptake on everything because I am stunned.
Sure.
Earthquake number two. My mother says, I have known all along.
What?
What? What? You've known what all along? You have allowed this to happen, Shelley. I had no idea what PTSD meant in 1977. But I am being engulfed with PTSD. Me and my three brothers, none of us had any clue what was going on. Earthquake number three for me and my brothers is the most devastating one of all. And you probably say, what could be more devastating than that? Your brothers, you've just learned your sisters have been sexually abused by your stepfather, and we would learn it was horrific what they went through in so much silence. They were just locked down from telling us boys, you know, the typical threats. I will hurt them. I will kill them. I will hurt you. All of those things that keep anyone who's dealing with sexual abuse usually locked in place, child or adult, it makes no difference.
Right.
It is enough to shut you down.
Right.
My mother has said what she says, but what got us, and this is why it's from a brother's perspective, what we carry in silence. My oldest sister, who's pacing back and forth, spins around and points a bony finger at her four brothers and says, you can't talk about it. It didn't happen to you. It only happened to us girls. And like that, relationships between brothers and sisters that were so incredibly tight because all we did was play together. We sang, we played together. We didn't gangbang. We didn't do anything. We didn't get into any trouble ever.
Right.
Those were done. And for a brother, what do you do? Where do you go when the most important people in your life that you need to talk to just told you we want nothing to do with you? It became a 45-year journey of shock and disbelief, guilt and shame, anger, betrayal, confusion, crisis, all of the fear and anxiety, loss of self-esteem, woulda, coulda, shoulda moments that I should have handled but did not handle. But I'm a brother and I'm told you can't talk about it. And that's what happens to brothers, because no one ever asks, are you okay?
Right.
Do you need anything? We are, as I said earlier, taboo, an inconvenient truth. So I have learned how to regulate, manage, and begin to heal. And it took me 45 years to do so, to get to my sisters, to be able to recreate those relationships in a way that were healthy for all of us. And so that's the framework or the groundwork for our discussion, because oftentimes when it happens, the betrayal comes out, there are four groups involved, but it's usually three that are addressed: the perpetrator who committed the crime, the person who knew or enabled, in this case, it would be my mother. That's number two. And number three, obviously, it is my sisters. But right. No one ever closes the loop for the family. What about the brothers? How do we help them? Now, I would learn years later and begin and understand why my oldest sister did what she did. Of course, she did what she needed to do. She's protecting herself. She's protecting her three youngest sisters. It took me a while to understand that. And if I'm in her shoes, I'm doing the same thing. Yeah. But the unexpected consequence is the shutting down emotionally of brothers who needed to talk. We didn't even talk to each other, my three brothers and I, about it, because we absorbed what was said so thoroughly, so completely. Do not talk about it. We never spoke to each other. And so I spend my time elevating the voices of brothers, bringing us into a conversation of which we are told you cannot participate, but you are expected to answer for your non-participation. How do we do that? How do we bring brothers and sisters into a conversation that we can help each other and move the family in a direction that is healing, that is loving? We figured out some things along the way, but it took us 45 years. So I know we have questions and comments, and I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation.
Wow, there was so much in that. So from an educator's perspective, I am curious. I had a situation when I was in third grade and my dad almost died from an accident. And I was in third grade in 1979. And so, you know, just like that phone call that you received, you know, somebody had to go to the wall and answer that phone. You know, there was no such thing as cell phones. There was no social media. There was no instant news. When I went to school, this happened over the weekend. When I went to school on Monday, and the accident was in December, my teacher knew that something was up with me.
Yeah.
And came and spoke to me at her first opportunity to do so. I can't imagine the earthquakes, as you called them, and then going to school the following week. Hmm. And trying to resume a quote unquote normal life. Can you remember that? Can you kind of walk through like what happened yeah. in the rest of your school years too? Because I'm, again, as a teacher and somebody who is trauma informed.
Yeah.
I imagine that there were things happening at school throughout the rest of your schooling. Well, you were yeah. a senior by the time you found this out. So,
yeah, you know, that is a very good question, which is one of the reasons I was so looking forward to speaking to you, because I do speak to educators and schools. As I was thinking about and getting prepared for our conversation today or this morning, it didn't occur to me until this morning that in 1977, I was a senior in high school. And I started thinking about it. Okay, what do you remember about your senior year? Because, you know, Shelly's probably going to ask you something about your senior year. And it occurred to me, I don't remember anything about my senior year. I was in so much trauma after what I heard. I don't remember anything. I don't remember how I even got to graduation. I have no idea, because the impact of what I heard was so complete in shutting me down. I did not want to do anything. I literally did not want to do a thing. And I look back on what it must have been like, not for me, but for my sisters. They are being sexually abused for 6 years. And they have to get up and go to school. They have to interact with their family, their brothers, aunts, uncles. We're doing shows. We're still doing all this stuff. And they are somehow finding the capacity, the will. How it, at their age, I had no idea how they did it. But here they are, 5 and 6 years old and 7 years old, and they have found a way to go to school, to interact. It went a long way toward explaining why they would react to certain things their brother said. Like, we would be playing, you know, it could be on a weekend. We could be playing a comics or playing something, you know, just doing something. And the reaction that we would get did not match what was said or done from a brother's, you know, perspective. They're like, well, why are you, you know, just reacting like that? Well, now I know. I know why it wasn't matching, because they are in this place of abuse that is ongoing. And so to your question specifically about me, I did graduate. I did immediately go to junior college, but I had to drop out because we still needed money. And I found myself not able to concentrate in junior college. There was just too much going on. I'm constantly sitting in class thinking about my sisters, imagining, I'm a brother, I'm imagining what has been happening to them. And in the book, Helplessness, which I'm so happy to say, three of my sisters contribute to helplessness. Two That's brothers funny. Contribute, and I never thought that would ever happen. Right. But 45 years later, we were able to get there together. So I didn't know how to handle it, because in 1977, there were no documentaries, there were no books, there were no courses, there was nothing for brothers. You could go to a library and you could find something for sisters, but primarily for women, about sexual abuse. And I say that with so much humility, because there never should be hundreds and thousands of books and papers about women having to overcome and deal with sexual abuse. It should never be a thing, but it was. And so my sisters could go talk to someone if they wanted, but they were still young. But there was obviously nothing for brothers. And the same thing is in place for brothers today. There are no books, there are no documentaries, there are no movies, there is absolutely nothing for us. So from an education standpoint back then, I just had to try to figure it out on my own. And the fear and anxiety of the stigma of someone knowing, and I'm a brother, you know, we're trying to keep this in, and we're still under contract with United Artists. So the deal with Motown falls through, and we owe United Artists a lot of money. So we have to keep going in some form or another. And because we had bills to pay, we had to eat. That was our only way of surviving off the money that United Artists was giving us. So I don't remember what happened to my education. All I know is that I graduated. That is it. I can't tell you anything. I did not have very many friends afterward, because who was I going to talk to? I don't know. I don't know how I got through it. I didn't think about it until this morning.
I have no scientific backdrop for this, but I think I'm a spiritual person, a faithful person. And I think that that's a way that God protects us and just sort of bubbles us in. I feel like that when people pass away, you know, when my dad passed away, I can't remember so many things that happened around that time. And for months after, you know, people will say things to me and I have no recollection of saying that or doing that or, you know, and so like I said, there's no science to my knowledge behind it, but I just think that's a protective measure. And so I so appreciate what you said though about in junior college, a year, 2 years later, you are even months later, you're still processing. And at that point, you know, your adult brain is an adult brain, and you had strategies and skills and things that had been taught to you. And by that point, your brain has developed to the point where you can process things and work through things and absorb things differently. But we have kids coming through schools today that are going, sadly, through similar situations to your sister's, but maybe to your experience as well, that they know they've seen their sibling be physically abused, or they know there was sexual abuse going on. And I always say that behavior is communication. And we, in my opinion, need to figure out what that behavior is communicating. And we may never know exactly in a lot of cases. I mean, if somebody were to talk to you when you were in junior college, you might not have been able to pinpoint, like, I'm always thinking about this, but you might have been because of your age. When we have kids in primary and elementary schools and suddenly their behavior is drastically different, something happened, and we need to try to acknowledge that something has happened and work with them through that. You know, when kids disobey, and there's consequences, but we also have to say, okay, what changed? Or if they maybe, you know, had been that kid who was the quote unquote bad kid, and suddenly they're just stoic. Something happened. Why did that change? We tend to always think bigger behaviors are because those get our attention. But if we have the opposite happening, we need to pay attention to that as well. So
the age part of it is very interesting, particularly when you talk about education. When I started writing Helplessness, in fact, I had just finished it, and I was going into a grocery store here in Southern California. And as I was entering, there's this group of high school kids outside the grocery store door, and they're raising money for some school project. And I stopped, because I always stop when kids are trying to sell something. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I asked these, there's about seven, eight of them, like five girls and a couple of boys. And I said, okay, what are you guys raising money for? And so they said, we have a school project that we are looking to fund. And okay, tell me more about it. He said, we are doing a project that is very close to our school. It is about sexual abuse taking place with our classmates at home.
Oh.
And I said, wait a minute, what did you say? We are doing a film for school about the sexual abuse with our classmates who are being sexually abused at home. Now, these are high school kids. And this is one of the richest high schools in the area that I live in. And it is predominantly white. And you have these kids who have recognized there's a problem. And the reason why I bring this up is because that's when I learned about what happened to my sisters in high school.
Right.
And oftentimes people will look at, you know, toddlers, not toddlers, but elementary school and maybe junior high or middle school. Mm-hmm. But the proliferation of sexual abuse in the home really began to take off here in America during COVID.
Sure.
Because a lot of students, you know, they didn't have the ability to go out, hang out. And for those predators in the home, they had a, you know, what I call a built-in audience.
Right.
One of the things that I'm oftentimes hit with when I'm talking about it from a brother's perspective, Shelley, is I will be at a speaking engagement. Invariably, there will be a woman who says to me, you know, Keeper, your sister is absolutely right. It did not happen to you boys. It only happened to them. So they're right. And I have two answers for that. And one is, well, you know what? You're right in one sense, but you're wrong in another. The right. Yeah, it happened to my sisters, but anytime sexual abuse happens in the home, it's happening to the entire family, whether you know it or not. Just because my brothers and I didn't know doesn't mean we weren't being affected by it. And my example is my sister's reacting to us in ways that didn't make any sense. And so we are being impacted by it. The other thing, because it's usually a woman who says this to me, is this. 6 years before my sisters were sexually abused, my older brother and I, at age 7 and 8, were sexually abused by our babysitter almost daily for 6 months. So I understand. And that's when the woman who will say, oh, I didn't know. And I said, I know you didn't know, but here's the thing. You should not have to know. This is not a game of whose trauma is worse, my sister's versus the brother's, because they were directly impacted and you are indirectly. We cannot play that game, particularly with kids in school. So I said, no, I know you don't know. But unfortunately for me, it means I understand both sides of the sexual abuse coin. I understand as a child, the direct victim and the indirect victim. And so for my sisters, and this is who I lean on, because what they went through, they are my heroes, you know, in spite of being told we can't talk to them. What they were able to go through and fight through in school, because I'm on the way to college, as you said, I already have the adult brain, but they're still developing. For them to figure out a way to get up every day and try to have a happy life, the only way that you can do that is you are strong within yourself to a degree, but you're also hopeful that something is going to come in or someone is going to come in and change it for them. Absolutely. Unfortunately for my sisters, aunts and uncles, grandparents knew, but they did nothing. And I think it's more from a generational standpoint. Back when I was growing up, aunts and uncles, they didn't get involved. You may have more people get involved today, particularly teachers who are noticing things, or a clergy may notice something. Someone may see something and pick up on signals. Back then, we just didn't have that type of education, so people weren't necessarily picking up on them.
Right. And what you mentioned before about the fact that your sisters told you that you couldn't talk about it, it makes perfect sense to me that you then lost friends and started to withdraw, because I can 100% see the brain going, well, we can't talk about anything because of the fear that something that you're not supposed to talk about will come out.
Yeah. And yeah, my sisters are protecting themselves. I get that. But like I said, Shelly, it took me a long time to come to grips with that, to accept that that was what was happening. Because initially, from a brother's standpoint, you want to protect, you know, your protective instincts, you want to do something. And, you know, when you can't, this depression and isolation sets in.
Yep.
But you know something needs to be done. So the psychological and the emotional impact for brothers is devastating, because we have no outlet. We have no place to go. The eroding of trust was one of the things that hit us right away. All of a sudden, our sisters did not trust us. They did not believe us, that we weren't allowed to engage with them. And so that is devastating, particularly because it's a family member. Oftentimes, people don't realize when it comes to children, and more teachers are being educated to look for signals. Our parents are the most important people we know. They are the most powerful people on the planet for us. Everything that we know and love is determined by their reaction. Whether we are doing well, you know, you get the reward of the hugs, you get the reward of you're doing fantastic. Those things are so important. Excuse me, they're so important to a child. And when we don't, we crave it. And so when we don't get it, and I look at my sisters from this standpoint, if they did not do what my stepfather and my mother knew was being held against them, that love and appreciation would have been pulled back from them. And they are very young and they don't know how to navigate that or handle that. And neither did I. So you're trying to regulate emotionally. And how do you do that as a kid? It's
Right.
impossible because adults can't handle this news. How is a child supposed to do it?
Exactly.
And then go to school? Whoo!
Yeah.
My sisters, amazing, amazing. And understand, I don't have great relationships with everyone anymore. The majority of them I
Sure.
do. But I think it's important when we talk about what's really happening and the type of support that we do or do not get, especially for brothers, that will determine who will we will become as men, who we will grow to become. My initial thing was helplessness, the mental health challenges. But the more I thought about it, Shelly, I realized, no, that's not it. It's not a mental health problem. That comes later. The problem is the emotional health challenge. Because mental is logic thinking, it is isolation. You're alone, you're in your head, you're doing it all by your own. You're trying to figure out it. Oftentimes, we go all over the place, usually not a healthy place. Emotion is feelings, it's shared experience, it's community. And we can't get the community, and the community could be your siblings. It could be your parents. It could be your teacher. It could be someone that you know. When you can't get that emotional trauma supported, then we go to the next place, which is mental. Because then you have to go in your head. And as a little kid, you're going to shut down. And as you get older, you start thinking of ways of how to push back, which can be very dangerous. And for me and my brothers, particularly for me, it became very, very dangerous, a place that I went to. And that's because I'm older and I know that I could do or attempt to do some things physically. But as a child, my sisters became withdrawn. Me, I was a chronic stutterer as a kid. And part of what happened to me when I'm 7 years old, I'm in the second grade and I'm being sexually abused by my babysitter, I really started shutting down. I just didn't want to talk to anyone.
Right.
And as my siblings saw that I was not talking, they mistook my trauma as me just being grumpy. I
Sure.
wasn't being grumpy. I didn't know where to go. And so by them misunderstanding what was going on, I was then being teased by them. And so it's really important that teachers are able to pick up once again on those signals that you were talking about, because that goes a long way in helping a child get through school in a really positive way, but also figure out a way to protect them at home.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a really big question to ask you. Have you forgiven your mom for knowing and not doing anything?
No, I think forgiveness for me requires that the individual some degree of remorse. For me, there has to be something. Otherwise, I am forgiving you for something that you should take ownership of, but you won't. No, I'm not big on just blanket forgiveness. Something for me needs to happen. And all too often for me, we're told, well, if you don't forgive them, then it's going to hurt you. Well, it doesn't. It is for me, it's like I'm giving that person a pass. They need to do something to show some degree of remorse. So I was able to figure that out for me. That works for me because it allows me to be myself. I know most people would look at it as no, you keep her, you should give her so you can move on. Well, I have moved on, but I have figured out that always saying just forgive, and I'm thinking, well, but they haven't taken responsibility for their action, so that needs to happen first before that's even a consideration for me.
Okay, next big question. Have you forgiven your sisters for telling you not to talk about it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, the reason I was able to write Helplessness, I was going to a book seminar on how to write a book in 20 minutes. And I did that. I went down to San Diego. But knowing that I was going to write Helplessness, I decided to contact one of my sisters, and I love my sisters. I decided to contact my second sister. And from a forgiveness standpoint, I think it's more them forgiving me and my brothers. But I said there were moments where I should have done something along the way, and I did not, because I was told I couldn't. And I didn't have the emotional wherewithal to find a way to, I've got to do this anyway. But ultimately, I was able to bring them some closure 45 years later by confronting my stepfather at a church. So my sister, I knew if I was going to write Helplessness, Shelley, I had to tell my sisters. I didn't want them to be caught off guard. And so I called my second sister and I said, I want to come over to the house and talk to you. And she said, okay, come on over. So we're standing out in front of her garage and I'm telling her, I want to write this book. And I'm waiting for the explosion to happen. I'm waiting for the wrath to just come pouring out of her. How dare you? You know, you can't talk about it. And keep in mind, my sisters don't know what has happened to me and my older brother. They just found out maybe 10 years ago. We didn't tell anybody. They had no idea. Okay. And so my sister, after telling her, I want to write the book, she says, of course you should write a book. All you boys should write a book. It's not a girl story. It's you boys' story. Of course you should write a book. And I didn't know what to do with that other than just break down in tears. I'm like, what? That's your reaction? After 45 years, that is what you're saying? No. I'm like, no, you're saying the wrong thing. Stop. You're supposed to be mad at me for having the gall to do this. But granted, it's a brother's story. It's my story, and it's a real story. But that's what she said. And that broke every shackle that I had. She gave me, and I understand, I wasn't looking for permission because I'm going to do it anyway, because brothers need to know this is what brothers go through. And also Helplessness gives sisters insight into what brothers go through. When one of my sisters read the book, she came back to me. She said, I had no idea. This is what you boys have been carrying all this time. I had no idea. I thought you boys just didn't care. And I'm like, no, you said we couldn't talk. So we had nowhere to go. So I told my second sister, and all she did was she just gave me a hug. She said, of course. And that just speaks to time, evolution, growth. And then I told my two of my older sisters, my other sisters, including the one who said you can't talk about it. That's another trauma. Me picking up the phone, the collar, and hanging up. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, no.
Well, because I'm so scared, Shelley. This is the one who said you can never talk about it. She's 11 months younger than me. And this is just the trauma brothers carry. We want to still talk because along the way you hear the, how come you didn't see my tears? How come you didn't hear me weeping? You hear that at a Thanksgiving. And keep in mind, we, over those 45 years, we still had fantastic times together.
Well, that's
good.
But
you're still kind of walking on eggshells as a brother.
Sure.
You know, you want to say something. This is what I'm dealing with, but you can't. And so I called my oldest sister, and it took me a day to literally do the thing. I would pick up the phone, hang up, pick up the phone, hang up, like, I can't do this, I can't do this. She's going to be so mad, but I'm going to do this anyway, because brothers need to know, other men need to know, they need to know they're not alone as well. You can do this, you can do this. The next day, I pick up the phone. The previous day, while I'm hanging up, more important things happen. I had to watch the paint dry on the fence outside. I need to go wash some clothes. I needed to go shine some shoes. It was so much more important than talking.
Right, absolutely.
But you're making
Yeah,
up
we
stuff.
Can always find things when we don't want to do something. Yep.
Yeah, I am projecting big time, but I get her on the phone, and she's silent for about a minute, and I'm just waiting. But I did what I needed to do. That is so key to your healing, is do what you need to do. Or as the Dr. Susan Jeffers in the book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, I felt the fear and I did it anyway.
Right.
And so after a minute of silence, all she said was, okay. And I thought to myself, what?
No.
45 years and all I get is okay? You can write it? But that's how we grew. And now my relationships with my sisters, you know, our story ultimately ends as one of hope and triumph and resilience and surviving and thriving. But I have great relationships with three of them now, and I never thought that would have been possible. You know, starting out in school and them in elementary school and us coming this far, but it was not easy getting here. And I know from a child sexual abuse standpoint, every day in America, at least 160 kids are uniquely sexually abused at home. Wow. Every day. So to put that in perspective, that means yesterday, 160 kids around America that we know of or that has been reported, unique, right, got up, went to school, played handball, played tetherball, played hopscotch, had recess, did all those things, went home, did their homework, hung out with their parents, and somewhere in the night, someone walked through their door 160 times. It will happen again tonight, 160 times. It will happen again tomorrow, 160 times, and the morrow after that, and the morrow after that. So it's real incumbent that everyone be on the lookout, because a lot of times, because of the technology and what's available to us, we are more vulnerable than ever. Our children are more vulnerable than ever with everything, but especially this. So we have to be prepared to step in and help. Because in our case, we're aunts and uncles and grandparents who knew, who did nothing, and they each had their reason, but no reason was good enough. Because in stepping back, what you ultimately did was serve us up every day.
Yeah.
You put us in play every day. So we have to be able to recognize that this happens and understand the relationship between siblings, gender, because for my sisters, I understood that what made me and my brothers instantly guilty was what was between our legs was between our stepdad's legs, and that made us guilty. And so we were guilty through proximity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't help anyone. Children are incredibly vulnerable. And so I look at my situation and my brother's situation, and by extension, my sisters, as our story will not end in tragedy. I refuse to let it end in tragedy. It will be used to help, to educate, to elevate, to bring everyone to the table, to close that loop where it's not just the predator, the empower, and the direct victim. It closes the loop that needs to be closed that also includes the brothers. Otherwise, the family is still and remains at risk until it is done.
Very true. And I so appreciate you sharing that perspective with me, because it wasn't one that I had ever considered before. And I want to make sure to say, I presume that anyone who would like to buy your book can go to your website and purchase it through your website. Okay. So that website is Keeper Katran Whitney, and it's KeeperKatranWhitney.com. I would love to talk to you for much longer. And I so appreciate your willingness to share what you shared today. This has been a very moving episode for me. And I have a feeling for those who were able to stay with us the whole time. I have put in the chat all of your social media. You're on Instagram, you're on TikTok, you're on YouTube, you're on LinkedIn, and I forgot to pull this one up. This time you're on Facebook as well. Please reach out to Keeper, and especially if you are the brother of someone that you know is being sexually abused and get his book. I can only imagine, I have not read it, but I can only imagine that it is very powerful. Based on the interview today, it's not an interview, based on our conversation today, you have very powerful words, and I'm sure that those are in print as well as what you shared with us today. And I thank you again very much for being willing to share your story and your whole family story. And please express my gratitude to your sisters and brothers who participated in the writing of the book, to share what they shared with you and their own experiences. In the book that I wrote, Those Who Can't Teach, it was a similar situation where families shared brutally honestly with me what it was like either being the parent of a child who was eligible for special education, being the person themselves going through special education, or you know, just being around. I found out a lot of things that I thought I knew about families that I had no idea about. And I'm sure that your book is the same way. So Keeper, again, thank you so much for being here. God bless you. God bless your sisters and your mom and your stepdad. And I pray for healing for all of you. And I hope, and this was a question that I don't know if you can answer. We've got like 2.5 minutes, but have you forgiven yourself? That's the biggest question of all.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Oh, yes. Yes. It's not always easy. Just the process of it. But I owe that to my sisters. My sisters made it okay for me. So, yes, I have forgiven myself because the realization is I did nothing wrong. But it's hard when you don't know,
absolutely,
right? You know, when you're feeling guilt, blame, and shame. But I didn't do anything wrong. So, but it took me a long time to come to grips with that. So yes, I have forgiven myself.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Well, thank you so much again. This is Thanksgiving week here in the United States. But when this airs as an actual podcast, who knows what time frame it will be. But I do want to wish you and your family happy Thanksgiving.
Absolutely.
And to all of my audience, happy Thanksgiving 2024. Be sure to like and subscribe so you do not miss an episode of Hashtag the Limits. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.